Score, the podcast. The only show taking you inside the studios of the world's most celebrated composers and musical storytellers. Presented by Spitfire Audio.
It seems like it's been forever. I'm Kenny Holmes. Robert Kraft, are you with me?
I am so with you, and it has been forever, and we are back, and we're bad, and we are season four in the house.
And it's so great to see you, which is a new addition to the show. We'll talk about that in just a bit. This is Spitfire. Wow. This is for the podcast presented by Spitfire Audio. What? I'm so excited about Spitfire coming back with us, too. And we're going to get to them in just a bit. But first, I want to introduce Matt Schrader and composer Carol joining us as always. Hey, guys. We have a big guest for you on our season premiere episode that we are thrilled about. There's a huge story to talk about that we've been wanting to get down into the details with, and that is the Snyder Cut. Our guest is Tom Holkenborg, a.k.a. Junkie XL, and he has a lot going on. Godzilla vs. Kong is also out there. Leading the theatrical numbers, one of the only films that's really been in theaters to register those kind of numbers, and it's nice to see that that's happening. But a ton to talk about with Tom about the Snyder Cut and doing this film during the pandemic, a four-hour score, a director's cut, really a super unique story for Hollywood. I don't think anything like this has ever happened before where the same film was released by a different director and a different composer.
Definitely not at that scale.
No, and with the same actors and shots and everything.
And the power of a lot to talk about. Media rocking into the cybersphere.
To new world, man. Yep.
Bring us Junkie XL, Zack Snyder, and the original cut, and it worked. Thank you. That's the end of our show. And
thanks for joining us, everybody.
Before we get to all of that, we do want to thank our sponsor, as I mentioned, Spitfire Audio, who stuck with us even through the pandemic. They're back for season four. We can't thank all those folks enough over in the UK who we've been trading emails with at different hours of the night to get this going. So thanks to all of them. And of course, they help all of you, aspiring composers, musicians. They make the orchestral sample libraries for film composers. Whether you're just starting out or a seasoned professional, Spitfire has so many sounds you will love.
It's kind of an amazing day to even talk about Spitfire because this morning, as a Spitfire fan and subscriber, in my inbox was a free Spitfire Labs
auto harp. Yeah, I saw that.
Really cool auto harp. And it's just one of the benefits because they release a new library in their free lab series pretty much every month, I think. And you can get an entire orchestra, which some of us are lucky enough to now have, which is their BBC Symphony Orchestra recorded in London, in Abbey Road. It's just an amazing product.
Yeah, and speaking of Abbey Road, at the end of this episode, you're going to hear a demo piece from their Abbey Road One Orchestral Foundations package. It's a 90-piece orchestra recorded in the same place as Star Wars, Indiana Jones, Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings, Avengers Endgame, and so many more right there in the big room. So we're going to play you a cue from that at the end of the show, so
can
stick around.
Can I
that.
Ask you?
It's really always, cool. Man, these samples are sounding so good
it's
nowadays,
unbelievable
too.
How good they are, and it reminds me that I need to ask my co-host, Kenny, one question since we're now visual and YouTube. Are you getting a little extra dough for product placement for the Abbey Road sign behind you? Because did I miss a bet here? Was there like an opportunity for me to cash in on some?
Yeah, you know, I'm getting some studio time out there for putting the book in my background here.
Oh, shoot.
Robert, you can fix this right now if you have a can of spray paint.
I need it.
And you can just go ahead to that back wall behind you.
I need it.
And
you'll
get the same pay as Kenny's getting.
Well,
the book and the mug are actually from when we shot there for a score.
I wonder if it'd be a conflict with the Aston Martin sponsorship I've worked out just for me. You know, Kenny, play your cards right. I might be able to get you.
Put the car behind
DB7,
you.
DB7, but, you know.
Record in your car.
They said, Robert, you and James Bond should be driving the same car. I said, you know, I've always felt that. Kenny, where were we before I got so distracted?
Well, I think our listeners were waiting on the edge of their seat to find out how much they can save by using Spitfire products for being fans of Score the Podcast. 25% off your first purchase of any Spitfire audio product with the promo code CORD.
It's a promo code score 2021. 7th is the promo code, which reminds me,
hey, that actually worked.
Composer Carol, do you use Spitfire audio prod? Oh, yeah. Go ahead. Is that a Spitfire? It's an augmented 7th? Yeah. Do you use Spitfire in your composing, Carol?
I do. A lot of times, actually, it's probably my go-to sample library. They just have so much stuff to offer, and every one of them is just like perfection to me. And I've used others too, but Spitfire is just somehow my go-to. So, yeah, I'm really glad they're sponsoring us. Yeah.
There you have it. And we even have
from the lips of a real composer.
And I didn't realize fully because of your camera angle that you were sitting at your piano so you could underscore some kind of conversational moments. If I said C major 7.
Oh, we're doing this?
Are we doing the chords?
With an A and yeah. There it is.
Name that chord.
Oh, are we doing
a
great
that? Game. Name that chord. Carol would win. That's
I know that tune.
I think I get performance royalties.
Yeah, you get like 4 cents.
It's a different key.
So Kenny.
All right, let's get back on track. Score 2020 is the promo code. Use it to get 25% off.
The longest read ever to start the show.
They're gonna love this. They are going to love this promo that lasted 17 minutes. Score 2021 is your promo code. Save 25% off your first Spitfire product. And again, after the show today, we'll play you a clip from that Abbey Road One Orchestral Foundations package. Right on. That's going to be after the interview with Tom Holkenborg.
Have I said right on?
Matt, I haven't seen any of you guys in person, really. I think, Matt, I've dropped a couple of things off in passing, but it was more like I was the paper boy just chucking it out the window. What have you been up to?
Yeah, we're kind of just all avatars now until we meet up again. But, you know, the great thing about that is now, as of this season, we have video on Score the Podcast. So if you prefer to, now we should still be doing everything so that our audio listeners obviously can listen along. So we don't do a whole lot of, wow, look at this cool thing right here. And, you know, so we'll still have to like reference those types of things, I guess. But now there's video. So people that like to watch this on YouTube can go there. Our Epiclef Media page will be posting episodes there. And you can watch the interviews with the composers. What we're doing right now, this kind of intro block that we do, we'll talk about current events and all that kind of stuff. And we have a new show this season because we're going to... So Score the Podcast is going to be basically an episode every 2 weeks. That's what we're going to do instead of the weekly format, which we've done before. The reason for this is it's been frustrating to our fans. The season ends too soon. How long have we been away? It's been 8 months or something
too
like
long.
That. There's been things happening. How are we going to talk about these things that are happening? We are going to have to start a new season earlier or something like that. Well, we have a solution for that now, and that is more Score. It's a Patreon show. It's fan-supported, so you do have to pay something to get access to it. That's how we are able to subscribe to all the tools we need in order to put it on and do the editing of it and all that stuff. But the great thing is it's year round. So now when something happens, big events, when the Oscars happen, you know, we did a few episodes of this already where we talked about the Oscars and who's going to win and all of that kind of stuff. I think maybe someone owes someone else barbecue now as a result of this. So check it out. More Scores on Patreon. You'll hear an ad for that in just a second. I'll tell you in the break how you can go access that. It's if you have the Patreon app, you already know exactly what to do. You just download the Patreon app, search More Score. But we've already done an interview with Carlos Rafael Rivera, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So to kick us off, we did basically life stories of Kenny and Robert. We did a pre-Oscars show, which now is irrelevant. So no one has to go back and watch that if they don't want to, unless you want to see the bets that people made that they got wrong and now they owe barbecue. Then episode 4, which just came out as you're hearing this, and that is an interview because we're going to be doing original interviews on MoreScore with Carlos Rafael Rivera. He is the composer of The Queen's Gambit on Netflix, only the biggest Netflix series of all time, who did amazing music for this thing and scoring chess. It was amazing how he had to try to time these things out to chess moves and first write music to the script and then write music to the picture. And he walks us through all of this stuff. It's also really interesting that he's a Miami-based composer, which is the first one of those that we've talked to on the show, and was able to basically score this whole series from Miami, which is really cool. And this is the world that we're in now. We're sitting in our different locations, able to talk with each other. And it's the difference 1 year of pandemic makes, but it's true with composers too. So Carlos walks us through all of this stuff. Really interesting hour, a little over an hour that we spent with him. We'll be doing a lot more so check point out more score.
In his interview, one of the interesting things about Carlos is he's a professor at University of Miami also. And so the way he describes things and explains reasons for, you know, decision making, and it's very teaching. He's explaining that, you know, not everything's going to go your way, and he has a really interesting way of telling his story, in that he's often telling it to students who are going to experience these trials and tribulations that he went through and that he's still going to go through. I mean, he's aware that he is on the hottest show in Netflix ever, but not every show that you get or not every film you get is going to be in that position. And he's very much aware of that. And it's really inspiring to hear the way he talks about his story and how humble and prepared he is for, you know, the future ahead, which is going to be ups and downs just like anyone else.
Especially so now though, to see him in those first couple, that rapid rise, that's it. Like he's was very secretive about kind of the next projects that he's working on. I didn't want to reveal too much, but like there's some big projects in the works now, which is really exciting for Carlos. And so anyway, we'll be doing more score basically on the off weeks of Score the Podcast. Plus we'll be doing some bonus episodes on stuff. It's going to be interviews with people that you might not ordinarily hear on Score the Podcast, but also some that you might. And we'll be doing original stuff there, hanging out. As always, your support means the world to us, and it allows us a lot more flexibility to hop on, talk about what's going on, and give you good, high-quality content that you'll only see on Patreon.
I and can't wait to hear Carlos talk about scoring a whole series about checkers. And then I know there's one on Parcheesi.
Is that the next
there?
One?
And I think they're going to move into...
Sorry, it's Sorry.
Well, Candyland is already a movie. So,
oh, yeah, that's right.
It's been a really interesting moment, hasn't it, for all of us to be able to do this? And I think composers, strangely enough, who are so accustomed to this interaction with the director and with the producers and the studio and the orchestra, to be deprived of that for a year, I think has been both upsetting, understandably, for a lot of composers, but it may have moved the whole field of composing into a little bit of a new reality, which is I can do a lot of this without ever seeing you. It might be a little different recording individual players from halfway across the world on a video screen, even though we'd moved slightly towards that. But I think, like all entertainment industries and maybe many others, the reality of Zoom has certainly changed the need for this incredible expense.
Well, a lot of that stuff's just getting so good now, too. So you can record things locally. You know, we now this season are using a new service, too, in order to do all of this stuff. So if you see any technical glitches, it's their fault and not any of us.
No, it's Kenny's fault.
That's right.
But so far, it's been pretty impressive. And this is the new technology, man. It's going to be really, really cool stuff. And awesome that you can score a series like The Queen's Gambit from your home studio in Miami. That's awesome.
And that you can do it just with a shirt on, because you only see the half up. Just like an episode of
Robert
Score.
You make way too many hints that you're not wearing pants. You know, it's over something the last couple
I don't
seasons.
It's called Donald Ducking, and it's just, you know, one of those secrets. One of those secrets I don't reveal, though. I guess if you're listening to More Score and subscribing to the Patreon subscription, We may, in fact,
and you'll know the secrets.
Kenny, don't we have a kind of episode coming up where people can write in their questions? I've seen some questions, and I thought maybe what we'd do is have a Morse score where yours truly and a couple others on the screen answer some really interesting questions from composers and
Yeah, we could do a long-form Q&A thing where we have plans to do stuff like that.
I saw
that.
Some good questions come into the inbox, so, and we used to do the mailbox.
Yeah. We will.
We'll still good. Be doing it.
We have a packed show intro today, so we won't do it this week, but we already have some questions.
We still got to talk Oscars. Now, this is airing a little bit after the Oscars aired, so we don't want to spend too much time on old news, essentially, but it was a kind of rough start for the Oscars. Well, the telecast that they had was the lowest rated ever by a long shot. So not many people are watching. It is a year in which it's a real weird year, as we all know. The projects coming out are different than what you would normally see. You're not hearing the same marketing and buzz for things. And, you know, there's an argument to be made that they're holding some of the best projects for next year when hopefully everyone's back, you know, flocking to theaters. But what were your impressions of the Oscars this year?
Are you asking our audience or our
I can't hear them, but
yeah.
Yeah, interesting.
I thought
good one,
first of
Jim.
All, I was really close on my ballot. I am so impressed that I psyched out a couple categories. Though the one that everyone seemed to miss that I talked to was, of course, the one that completely messed up the telecast, which is the big finale of Chadwick Boseman winning. We've all read it to death, but Anthony Hopkins winning not only was fabulous for Sir Anthony Hopkins, and also, you know, Chadwick Boseman did a great job, and that was an amazing movie, and of course he's passed, but I read a really wonderful piece about how the producers of this year's Oscar telecast, particularly Steven Soderbergh, made a bet that they could have a big emotional ending, and they bet the house that this is the way it's going to go. And like many things with Murphy's Law attached, oops, it just didn't work. But I think in the category... Well,
if there is anyone... I was just going to say, if there's anybody thinking that the Oscars, if they know the answers or if it's rigged in some way, that just answered that, because that blew up in their face for sure.
They actually thought
they just cut to Questlove and he's like, well, all right, everybody have a good night. And it was like, whoa, that was really anticlimactic.
But I actually, in our category, which is the music category, I felt pretty good about the way that I predicted it, though I feel miserable for our great friend Diane, who has every year come so close and been, of course, Diane's getting it this year. I mean,
Diane Warren, who's been on the show last season or two seasons ago, I think. We had her on the
two
show.
Two seasons ago,
and of course, the song from Judas
12 was times nominated.
Great. And her is super cool and could not be at this moment having a hotter career moment. But Diane was ready for her first Oscar win and didn't happen. Of course, Trent Atticus and John Batiste taking it for Soul, that was just a lock. I don't think anybody really had much hope for it going. I heard an interview with James Newton Howard where even he seemed kind of resigned that he was going to be attending as a nominee and leaving as a nominee. But, you know, I love award shows. I particularly love award shows when they go south. So I got a lot of pleasure out of this, seeing it be just kind of a dog's breakfast a couple times with things that didn't work. And really, we're going to have Glenn Close twerking? I mean, you know, I guess. So, all good, but we love show business.
I think it was really missing the numbers. The musical numbers is what keeps the energy of the show. I liked the vibe. I liked the layout. But those breaks with the musical numbers that kind of get you, it's entertainment. It's not just talking. I will say, though, I really liked the way that they gave little backstories to some of the craft categories, no pun, I know you like to make that craft pun. Not you, the craft workers. But the way they would say, you know, this costume designer interned under this other costume designer, and now they're up against each other. Like, it gives a little bit of a backstory,
and I think you've
because
also just solved
a lot of those people that
they knew that one audience member of the 10 million that watch actually liked that, and we just found out who it was. It was you. So,
well, Matt, but Matt pointed out that they were missing like the visuals to marry that up to it. So show us, you know, a little bit of the work that they did, because it was a lot of just talking and showing people.
Yeah, it's tricky when you have like, oh, here's the cinematographer of such and such, and it's just he's just kind of like
drinking his drink,
and they're just still talking about him, and he's like, "What do I do? I'm just
there's things they can take from this." To next year, and also bring back what they've always
done. The cocktail
done,
party vibe, it's very old school Hollywood thing. I love that, actually. I actually thought that was a cool thing to bring back instead of like the grand ballroom, big kind of, you know, the corporatized broadcast kind of thing. I like it being a little smaller. But yeah, they got some other things to work out for sure.
Anything else in our A block that we want to hammer home before we get the Junkie XL? Which
we're using our production lingo, our A block. Oh,
did you want to deep tease that Robert? Or did you want to?
Is a
should we float
term
that?
That our audience should know because they're experiencing it right now. The A block is.
It means you're A plus
that's
content.
Exactly right.
Robert, I had a question for you that I have been saving for this. So we have Tom Holkenborg coming on in just a bit, who is, you know, obviously this composer of the Snyder Cut. And in this situation, he was fired, so to speak. I mean, there were talks that he wasn't really wanting to stay on anyway, but ultimately they made the decision. And then he comes back. But I'm wondering from your experience as an executive, when someone's fired, how does that work with like the pay structure? Because they're not paid hourly. So do they get some sort of a percentage of how much they worked on it? And how much does that affect the music budget if, you know, this far along you're replacing with somebody else? Because that's got to be a big problem for you in
that
seat.
That is a great question. It really is. First of all, and you know the great quote attributed to Jerry Goldsmith, but everyone knows that quote, which is, you're not a real Hollywood composer until you've been fired off a picture. So that's nobody escapes that for whatever reason. Sometimes you're an incredible composer and just director's having a bad day and can't figure it out, or the studio doesn't know what the movie is and they want to go a different direction because maybe the music will solve it. But to answer your question, I think the answer is twofold. One is you get paid what the deal is because somebody made a deal for their client, right? An agent made a deal for their client to score your picture. That means that client turned down other pictures. That means that your client has reserved those 4 months to work on it. That means your client is counting on that income. And so the agent will come back to the studio and say, you promised my composer $500,000 for the score of the XYZ movie, and the fact that the director decided to go in a different direction is not my problem. You have to pay my composer $500,000. That's one approach, and I've seen that. The studio will often come back with, and obviously this is all kind of done in a very, you hope, cordial fashion. They'll say, you know, we understand your point of view, but all your composer did was turn in a couple weeks worth of demos. He or she didn't work for 4 months. Maybe we can settle this at, and the studio will say, $50,000. And the agent will say, banging the phone on the desk, I'm sorry, did you say 50 or did you mean 250? And somewhere in there, usually what happens is they settle, because unless it's all the way near the end, I mean, I've been on scores that have been thrown out virtually done, then it's not a no-brainer. The composer gets paid full freight, and then you have to get your music budget reassessed and find another $500,000 from the studio. And it's always, believe me, it's none of it is pretty. But depending on where in the sequence the composers let go, you try and settle out the composer where everybody feels taken care of. The composer loves you still.
Plus, the composer doesn't want to burn any bridges because maybe if he's working for 20th Century Fox, he wants to be considered for other things down the road. So it's in his best interest to try to be equitable there too.
Does the new composer coming in, are they able to demand a little bit more because not only are they doing the same job, you know, scoring this film, but they're also doing it with less time, more pressure. Are they able to negotiate that up a little bit, or do they generally get kind of the same that the other composer
once
was
again
going to get?
The answer to these questions is pretty consistent. It's a negotiation. If the new composer coming in has just been asked to score a major film, he's a young composer without a lot of credits, and this is the biggest shot he's ever had, he will say, I will do this for the price of lunch. I am so excited. And I've been in that situation where you're out of time, you're out of money, and there's a cool young composer who is someone that you want to take a shot with, and you say, this is all we have, and the answer is good. And as you can imagine, if you go to one of the titans of film composing to say, we need you to bail us out and we've got 4 weeks to go, that's a really good place, you can imagine, for an agent to be in to say, great, here's the price, assuming the studio will say, but that's twice what he usually gets, and the
well, you're giving him a fraction of the amount of time.
Like all things in Hollywood, people think there's kind of a rule book. Boy, all of these are negotiations and conversations and whatever way you can get it done and however desperate you are. Desperation does not smell good is one of my favorite expressions.
The Justice League thing is so interesting because it came out, you know, our first episode last season was Danny Elfman, and he came in to basically replace Tom, who is the interview you'll see in a few minutes. And it's amazing because now, granted, they changed some things in the Snyder Cut, you know, that are quite a bit different now. But a lot of these sequences, you can see, you can compare side by side and see how two different composers scored something. There's these great examples of scores in history that have been thrown out and replaced with someone else's. I think of like Pirates of the Caribbean, you know, Alan Silvestri, I think, wrote up the first score for that and they didn't like it. And then basically, you know, Hans and his team was called in with, I don't know, 3 hours to go or something, tiny
Chinatown
amount of time. And obviously that score is a super catchy tune in a lot of ways. So they really, that's very famous for a reason. But never have we really been able to see how a previous score was applied to the film. And in this case, you can see that in Justice League. And it's interesting to see the way Danny Elfman approaches something and the way Tom Hulkenberg approaches something, because there are different minds at work. I don't want to get into like who did what better, because there's
like a master
class. Subjectivity there, but it is something that is fascinating to see the musical storytelling tools, you know, those gears turning, and the music is doing things in both of those versions. It's really cool.
Which kind of
and when you pit them side by side, along with the music, the editing decisions, the coloring, and the feeling you get from watching the combinations of these things, this is something that I believe will be used in curriculums at film schools, because you've never really had something at this level that, like Matt said, has actually been released.
That feels
and you
complete.
Can put, you can put side by side and be like, all right, you want to feel this way? Look how this pop song was used, like when Aquaman's walking out of that bar. Two different songs are used in the regular version of Justice League and the Snyder Cut, and you feel completely different about Aquaman in those shots with the way that the scene's colored and everything. So the combinations of all those for a film at that level, it's really, really interesting, and hopefully it can be used in something, because, like we said, we haven't really seen this happen before. Robert, were you surprised that movie came out
like
it did after the fact?
I've never seen that, and it's a... It's just like all things, it's kind of this alchemy of HBO Max needs content. They have this thing. You know, these things have to line up at so many levels. You have to have an executive somewhere that says, hey, wait a minute. There's this energy to re-release it with the right cut by the director. And there was all the haters on the current cut. And so I've never seen it. But like most things, we're in a new era where things are just surprising. Yeah. The really fun part about the comparison, the side-by-side, is it should be done. Somebody should just take four scenes.
It's been done. There's a bunch of YouTube ones already. They wasted no time.
I actually would save.
And I'll bet our friend Sulan in Kalamazoo, at Kalamazoo College, this is the kind of thing that she could really dive into. Oh, that'd be really interesting
to hear the emotional take of each interpretation. I would save sometimes temp versions of scenes next to the real one and show those in classes, particularly temp versions of songs where you'd have a big hit song and then you'd find out you couldn't afford it, so you had to go find an unknown song, and how that had a different response. But God bless Zack Snyder and Tom Holkenborg for pulling it out of the fire and making an incredible statement and an incredible movie. And it'll be interesting to talk to Tom and have him tell us about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Before we get to that interview, Carol, you do have a new album out, and we wanted to ask you about this because it came out during our off season. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about your album.
I'm so nervous.
A duet.
Yeah,
right?
It's a piano and vocal duet. This is my very first album, and I've never thought of doing this. And it's just a little something that, so I'll tell you more about it. It's a piano vocal duet. I co-released this with my friend. Her name is Pepita Salim, and she's the singer in this album. And she's a friend who I've been making music with since middle school, where we grew up together in Jakarta, Indonesia. And yeah, we just wanted to do something fun. Wanted to share this with the world. We just hope this can bring some comfort to everyone's days and reminding people to smile. The album is called Smile. So yeah.
And very cool. I've listened to it.
Do you want
to
give us a little?
Oh, yeah. Live? Oh, go.
She has her piano there. Do you want to give us a little something? I don't know if we can hear it.
Well, spot, are we?
What were you going to say, Robert, before?
I just said I've listened to it, and it is a smile. It's so beautiful. I recommend going to Spotify. Carol Cusuanto, Smile. It's beautiful.
Smile. Here, I'll play a little something. It's the piano interlude.
Isn't that what they say on one of those talk shows? Or play us in.
Okay, here we go.
Isn't that amazing? It's very casual that composer Carol can just say.
Well, her medleys are amazing whenever we have a new guest and Carol does a medley of something. So I'm super excited about this.
Isn't that beautiful? It's just incredible.
Go check that out, guys. Composer Carol, Carol Cusuanto on Spotify. The album is called Smile. I think it's time. Should we take a break and we will
Carol's
come back with
out.
Tom Holkenborg.
We're smiling and we're going to come back. There it is. With Junkie XL, a.k.a. Tom Holkenborg. Season 4 is in the house.
Let's go.
Hey, it's Matt Schrader here. If you like Score the Podcast, you're going to want to check out More Score, our new Patreon show for Score superfans. What's Patreon? Well, it's a website and an app that lets fans crowdfund the type of extra content you want. And now, More Score has it all on video. You can listen or watch right on the Patreon app. More Score already has the life stories of people you know, like Kenny and Robert from Score the Podcast, as well as bonus features, hangouts, and yes, original interviews, like Carlos Rafael Rivera from The Queen's Gambit on Netflix. Did you know he had to throw out his score and start fresh? More Score gives you insight into the film score world, and it's a beautiful addition to those of you who just can't wait for another episode of Score the Podcast. Best of all, More Score is year-round. No more off-season. Go to patreon.com/morescore or download the Patreon app and search More Score.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
My name is Emil Mosseri. You're listening to Score the Podcast. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to the season premiere of Score the Podcast. Super excited. You know our guest. He joined us in the first season of this show, and he's coming off a massive year. He's got Zack Snyder's Justice League on HBO Max, which was a total huge success and hit, and Godzilla vs. Kong on there also as well, which is, I think, still the number one movie at the box office. Tom Holkenborg is joining the show today. Tom, how you doing, man?
It's okay. I'm trying to sit up straight, so to relieve my back a little bit. Other than that, it's fantastic. It is a fantastic start of the year. So it actually was a great year for me last year, besides the all the pandemic issues. But work-wise, it's been really blessing and really great.
Well, you set a very high bar for the show because we're starting with the number one movie in the marketplace and the number one composer in the marketplace. So every other episode, they're going to have to live up to where you are. However, I feel unfortunately, I feel remiss that your back has been giving you issues. And as I was suggesting earlier, when mine hurts, I often think it's pressure. You know, it's literally, and I was thinking, well, Tom is under so much pressure with so much work, but I didn't realize till you told me that you once fell off a stage, and that's the genesis of it. Can you tell us when and where you fell off a stage? Were you in the middle of a punk mash pit?
This is like back in the day when I was way younger and I was way angrier and way more, even more energetic than I am now. I was touring with Junkie XL, and so the early days, so somewhere in the 96, 97 in Switzerland, and it's like one of those type stages, you know, like the size of Coachella, the main stage, like really big stage, wow. Very high. And where I was standing on the stage, like a good 6-7 feet behind me, there was like a crawling hole with a metal stairs to go down and check things like amplifiers and generators for power. And they didn't shield it off with like a gate or something. And I was jumping and standing backwards, and then woof, I just fell through and just landed on my back.
Terrible.
And so since then, my lower back is like a reoccurring issue. Usually, it's no problem as long as I keep doing my yoga exercises, my stretching exercises. And so what you mentioned, Robert, being under stress and being under pressure is a contributing factor whether you have issues with your back or not. But it's a very complicated string of events that can lead to a reoccurring episode of my back problems. It could be as simple as lack of sleep, the food, the eating habits haven't been so great, potentially pressure, making a wrong move, slipping on the exercises, not maintaining them. You know, it's a complicated. But it's like, you know, it's like having a toothache, you know. When you go through a whole year or 2 years without toothache, you're not enjoying every day that you don't have toothache. You know, you get reminded once you get toothache, and then after you come back from the dentist, you're like, oh, am I glad that this toothache is gone? But then 2 days later, it's back to normal, right? So you forget how you got that toothache in the first place. So it's very similar.
We saw the drum you built for Godzilla versus King Kong, and hopefully you're not lifting that thing up. Can you tell us, if you haven't seen his social media post of this drum, this is a 6-foot drum. You're always building, and especially you're a percussionist at heart anyway, but where do these ideas come from to just build a drum? There's got to be drums already existing.
Yeah, but who doesn't want to have a drum that's 6 feet in diameter, right?
I mean, everybody wants one in their own house. Yeah. I love that part of the videos.
Yeah.
It would look so cute behind Carol next to the acoustic guitar, a 6-foot drum. It would look so great. So
you're right.
Backdrop.
But no, the idea was that I use percussion a lot in my movies, and I work together with this incredible instrument builder who is from the Pacific Islands, but he lives in San Diego. And Christian Verbeek is his name. Hmm. And so he built these incredible original instruments. And at a certain point, I wanted to complete my assortium of instruments with like a really big, massive bass drum that would sound incredibly great for the movies that I'm working on. And so we decided to build one from the ground up. It took like 5-6 months. That thing got delivered at my studio, and it was like, shit, where do I put this thing?
Oh, no. That's my question. Well, because we know you just did a huge garage sale and sold a bunch of your stuff, so you probably made a little room, right?
All right. Well, a garage sale is a slight understatement. I absolutely yeah. sold everything, you know. Not some of my stuff. I sold everything. And
really?
Mm-hmm.
Ah. Electronics as well as acoustic instruments?
Everything.
Oh, you should have seen that there was pages and pages of this incredible gear. What inspired that?
To be exact, 1,700 items were for sale. So what inspired it is that I have been collecting instruments since 1979. And so I used to work in a music store. People would trade in all these instruments, and for people out there that have worked in retail, it's like when you trade something in, basically what you're paying the customer is so little, because you need to store that instrument, you need to repair it, you need to fix it, you need to make advertising for it, you need to make space in your shop to sell it. So in those days, if people arrived with like a memory Moog now worth $30,000 or so, we would say $50, if that, you know. And so they would take it. They were happy to get rid of their instruments that were so horribly out of fashion in 1981, 82, 83. So they dumped all these analog synths basically in our lab for nothing. And I decided to buy them all. It made my boss very happy, because, you know, I just paid him the money that we just paid the customer for as a trade-in. And he didn't have to deal with any of it. He didn't have to repair it, you know, no space in the shop. And so that's where the collecting started. And it wasn't done with like some brilliant vision in the future that one day these things are going to become very valuable. It wasn't done as, oh, the sound is going to be very hip in 20 years from now. I just loved these instruments, and I thought they were beautiful, beautifully built, beautifully designed, and I started buying them. And I also had the space. I was playing in the bands back in the day, and we had our own studio in a farm, so we had all the space in the world to store these instruments and use them. And so now we're all the way up to 2002, the year before I moved to Los Angeles. And I had this massive space in Amsterdam with all these instruments and drum kits and outboard gear, Telefunken compressors, Fairchild compressors. I mean, you name it. I had the whole lot. And then I moved to LA. I moved with like a very simple setup. And as I got more rooted here and my career was getting more solid, I started shipping out more and more of these instruments. And so eventually I had everything back here in LA that I used to have in the Netherlands. And
did you have a farmhouse here to store it in?
No. But you know, my studio space was relatively big, and I have a separate studio house where it is just studio, and everything was in those two buildings. And at a certain point, it started to weigh on me. You know, that I was walking around, and I was thinking, oh, I should really make music with that beautiful box today. Oh, I should really do this, but I couldn't because I was working on something else. And then the moments that I did want to use it, it was not working, you know, because these are vintage instruments. So the frustration and the guilt was growing over time. And at the same time, I was in a process of like getting rid of things in my life that I really don't need. So it was the perfect storm, and I decided to sell everything. And the decision was taken 2 years ago. It took a year of prepping inventory, like all these instruments, ship them all to Reverb in Chicago and then sell them all. It was a process of 2 years, and not one day did I regret it.
Answered my next question, which is any buyer's or seller's remorse, you know, like, I wish I had that one analog synth for this sound.
Well, and I will say, I've talked to at least two of our listeners who bought something of yours. So made a lot of people happy, just, you know, wanting to get something that their favorite composer used. I think that's pretty cool. And a lot of this stuff is, like you said, it's collectors. It's stuff that you can't get somewhere else, right? I mean, these are hard to find pieces, and they also happen to be in, you know, held by one of the best composers in the world. So it's
so
a pretty cool
fashionable
thing for someone
right
to buy
now
it.
To have the real one.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, in all honesty, I mean, I loved having all this vintage gear, but it will always be vintage gear. And so you're not going to reinvent the wheel with something that was invented in 1968. You know, if you want to reinvent the wheel and make new sounds and make something original and creative, I wanted to gear more towards equipment and instruments that are really of the 21st century and not of 1960, 70, and 1980, where technical progress was limited. And I do love the sound, but it's always going to be that, you know. You can buy an original amp that was used by Jimi Hendrix, and the same Big Muff pedal and the same Fender guitar, and you can use the settings that Jimi Hendrix did. It's never going to sound like The Edge from U2. It's going to sound like Jimi Hendrix. So if you want to go to a new way of creating sounds, you would have to use different type of equipment.
I kind of love the fact that your solution to making new way of sounds is to get someone to build the most ancient instrument on the planet, a drum. You know, it's sort of, you think that the end of that sentence would be, so I had like new technology that's never been used and NASA builds it for Mars, but I got, no.
Like, I need some skin. Yeah.
I'm going to build something I bang on, which is really phenomenal. I do want to know, though, just for my own musical curiosity, do you feel that there's software that can mimic the sound of those analog synths sufficiently that to the untutored ear, well, you can throw out the hardware because right now you can dial it up in some kind of patch.
And save space too, right?
Even to the tutored ear, sometimes it's very hard to tell them apart. I mean, like, we've done a lot of A-B comparison in the studio. There's actually one studio time that I released where I compare classic synths with their software counterparts, and I dare the listener, close your eyes and tell me A and B, which is the hardware Jupiter 8 and which is the Arturia plugin. 50% of the people just got it wrong every time. And so, and these are trained ears. You know, these are people that are synth experts. Now, is there a difference between a plugin and a hardware synth or any hardware? Absolutely, because the romance and the physical experience of sitting behind a piece of history that is 50 years old, of which there are only 3,000 made, and the synth that I had was owned by Michael Cimbello, who wrote the hit Flashdance for...
I'm a maniac.
Exactly.
Maniac on the floor.
He wrote that song on the synth that I had. And so So add that to the magic to it. So that makes it a magical experience. But is it better than a plugin? By no means. And so obviously there is going to be a bunch of purists that will go really into... they will take you to battle when it comes to these kind of things. And for that matter, it's the same with classical instruments as well. I mean, they're... people that swear with like a certain cello builder from Italy from the mid-1900s, whereas other people say, no, I can't stand the sound of that cello. I want a cello from this builder, you know, 50 years before that, because of the wood or because of this quality or that quality. Everybody has a very strict performance where for the untutored ear, a cello is just a cello, right?
Oh, it's so interesting. Yeah, and you could even, of course, I'm sure there's cello samples that you think, wow, that's such a beautiful instrument when it's really just some bits and bytes. Tom, you mentioned studio time. I mean, you have this enormous following. This may be contributing to your back issues because you're not only writing hit scores, but teaching so many of us about your career, your life, your instruments. Did you have that idea? It's just, I'm not here. Tell them I've stepped out to hang out with Junkie XL. So was that your idea to start that? Did somebody approach you and say, hey, we want to go online with you and have you do a whole series of master class-like things? Or did you say, I want to share what I know?
The history of that is that... my mom was a music teacher, and so when I grew up, she was teaching music classes and flute classes, simple piano, simple violin to young kids. And in the night hours, she would teach kids from less fortunate families and not charging any money for it. So that's already how I grew up. Education in Holland is for free or nearly for free, so we don't have those crazy numbers. If you want to go to Harvard or to Berkeley here, you know, you pay, you know, basically a mortgage for a house. And so in the mid-2000s, I was asked to set up a four-year music course at the biggest music university in Holland, Artes. And I did that, and I was connected to that university for almost 10 years. And then we separated ways, so I was able to do other things and they were able to move on. And then I was basically brainstorming with a few people, what shall we do next? And that's where the idea for Studio Time was born, is to basically create tutorials for young composers, aspiring composers out there. Sometimes they're very technical in nature. How do you set up this? How do you set up that? Other times, it's analysis of how music is being made. And other times, it's really deep analysis of what film scoring is, how it works, dynamics with the studio, with the producers. There's a segment that's called Ask Me Anything, and people ask all kinds of random questions, and I answer them as honest as I can. The only downside of Studio Time is what I would love to do, but I never get permission for it, is actually show the picture that I'm working on, but nobody allows us to do that.
How has Studio Time changed? Because you've been doing it now for several years, and it's a really high quality production value too. It's not just a webcam and Tom on his computer. I mean, this is some really professional looking stuff. Have you been experimenting with different ways to show people things? Because there's a lot more tools available now too with the pandemic and ways to stream. Are you doing any live stuff?
There are so many tools available right now. I mean, when we started, we basically hired a crew to film it and to edit everything. Little did we know, and it was relatively expensive. And we started talking to somebody that we know who said, who we asked, what would it cost to build like a setup permanent like that in the studio? And the number was like $500,000 or something. And it was insane. And now, this year, for the first time, we actually bought the whole setup ourselves. And so cool. We do it completely in-house right now. But now you can do it for under $20,000. Everything. Professional lights, professional cameras, editing software, streaming software, everything. It's incredible. And so now the interesting thing is that not only can we do stuff live, but I can record studio times in a very dynamic fashion when there's a lot of... A very good example is that when Justice League came out, there was one particular theme that really stood out for all these fans for this movie, which was the theme for The Flash, which for me was a great piece of music, but I had no idea that the fans would really be gearing towards that particular theme. And it's like outplayed by any of the other tracks of Justice League by 1,000 times on Spotify or something. It's insane.
Wow.
I'm not talking about 1,000 more plays. I'm talking about 1,000 times more plays. So it's insane. And so there was a question, oh, please do a studio time on that theme. And since we have that stuff ourselves right now, we could just dynamically plan in, okay, let's record one today just about this theme. So it's really great, actually.
And when you say it was in Justice League, which Justice League version or both?
Well, I didn't finish the music for the first one, so we're only talking about the second one. The right. First movie was finished by Joss Whedon. The score was done by Danny Elfman. And so they're completely two different movies. A different score, different storyline, everything different. I never saw the first one. I never saw the Joss Whedon one.
We kind of wanted to get into the story because, you know, obviously there's some tragedy attached to it, and we don't want to spend too much time on that. But the story of how this movie came out, and then there was fan interference and a petition.
You mean?
Petition. Yeah. I don't know why I blanked. I was thinking protest, but there was a petition to rescue Zack Snyder's version. And I would love to know, we've seen the stories and it was told by Zack Snyder several times, but I would love to know from your perspective how this all unfolded. Because I think when we had you on last, this was had just happened and we didn't really want to get into it at the time. Can you just take us back to that time? So, you know, obviously your great friend Zack Snyder tragically lost his daughter and you were still on board with the film at that point and Joss Whedon was coming in. Can you tell us what happened at that point and then kind of walk us through the evolution of this crazy time? This is maybe the only time in history this has happened in Hollywood where a film has been re-released with two different directors, two different composers, but the same shots almost and the same actors and everything.
I don't know much about the facts on the very last thing that you just stated, but nevertheless, it is a unique scenario. At least let's agree on that. So for me, when... I knew everything that was going on back in the day, and I don't need to rehash it because Zach has been very open about that in various different interviews. So I was right smack in the middle of that. Also because, as you mentioned, Zach and I are really good friends, so there was a lot of conversation at night, what was going on and what transpired. when Zach stepped away, I was technically still the composer for 2 more days. So I met Josh the next day. I got a phone call from Warner Brothers. Hey, do you want to meet Josh? And I said, okay. The meeting was unpleasant at best. And basically when I left the meeting, I knew how this was going to play out. And at the same time, I was also thinking that a potential decision to continue to work on that film would really be based on conversations I would have with Zach, you know? But for me, I didn't feel motivated to now embrace a completely different vision on how that movie needed to be finished. So actually when Warner Brothers called me, Josh wants to work with Danny Elfman on this, I was actually relieved. You know, you have to understand when you have such a close relationship with a director and one is sidelined and now you have to encompass a whole new direction for a movie by a different director, while in fact it is the original set out idea of the director that just left. it just doesn't feel good, you know?
So as all of this starts to unfold, you know, they do this movie, it comes out, but behind the scenes, are you starting to see the petition and the momentum growing? Because this is something that couldn't have happened 15 years ago as fast as it did, at least.
Yeah, and there was an interesting detail. It's like you mentioned the petition that people signed to release the Zack Snyder cut. There was a second petition that was started to release the score. And so, right. And both got a ridiculous amount of signatures. And so, at a certain point, I mean, Zach and I were constantly in contact about a lot of different things because, you know, for starters, we were starting on Army of the Dead and you know, future movies that he's starting on. And then he asked me in December 2019, he said, what would it take to finish Justice League? I said, I don't know. What do you think? Yes, it's like, well, you know, maybe there is an opportunity. It's like, okay, let me think about that. So,
fill me in on one detail which I've either forgotten or didn't know. Had at that point when you say what would it take, had Zach been approached with this kind of, if we could go back and fix this, or was this just his own fantasy of, hey, if
no,
I wanted to petition?
I'm not 100%. Informed on the details, but I think by the time it was December 19, he and Warner Brothers HBO Max were discussing the possibility of getting this, because this is not a decision you take overnight, right? I mean, it's it was a massive undertaking when we started, and so it was officially greenlit, I think, last week, April in 2020, and I started summer in May. So I think those 4 months, 5 months before, were basically to put everything down on paper. What would it take to finish? Zach, what do you need to do to finish? Tom, what do you need to do? And then come up with the budget and just like, can we make this work? And so...
Were you guys seeing the petition, though? Were you commenting on that, like, privately? Like, can you believe this? Because that was pretty unique.
No, I stay away from that. I mean, like, it's like... It was heartwarming to see, especially for Zach, you know, that and that's especially what I felt when I heard that it was greenlit, so the movie could get released in its original vision. I was like, hail to you, man! You know, great for you. People will now see what you originally anticipated to set out. And then for me, funny enough, when I played some of these themes and pieces of music back of my original approach to this film, there are a couple of things that happened. I got in a really bad mood because I was like thrown back in that time period of turmoil and the drama surrounding Zach. And the fact that this movie was now going to get finished, for me, needed to be something like a celebration and not like... tear open old wounds. So that's one reason why I wanted to start from scratch. The second reason is my film scoring career is relatively young. I did my first movie solo in 2013. And in 2016, I started on Justice League. Now we're 2020, which is like, it's even more than half of my career ago, I started on Justice League. And I've worked... with George Miller, I worked with Peter Jackson, I worked with James Cameron, I worked with Robert Rodriguez, I worked with Tim Miller, with so many amazing directors and producers. Why would I not utilize all that knowledge that I got from these wonderful people and just start over and just make the best possible score I have in me at this point? So I called Zach and I said, would you mind if I start over? And he said, by all means, go for it. And so that's where my Mount Everest began, you know, the climb, because it's the longest film score I ever worked on.
You know, I absolutely love, I love this story, I must admit. And you answered, before we take our little moment, you answered every question I had, which is kind of prescient, which is, how do you go back and rewrite a score? how much had you grown between the first writing and the second iteration. I had never anticipated something that you also said, which is really interesting to me, that you said the actual music brought up emotions of that time. Of course it did, but that never occurred to me. I sort of assumed when I heard you started again that it was purely your own chops were now deeper, your skill set, your musical and narrative conceptions were now more developed from these other films. So you just wanted to get out there and say, look what I've learned, a new backhand, a new forehand, a new way to come to net, you know, whatever it is. You're now like an athlete learns things. It never occurred to me that emotionally the first one was tied in, and I really love that. Though I also have to say it's the anti-lazy approach to anything. Most people would say, you know what, man, I'm gonna just
I'm halfway done.
Let me just finish this up and move on to the next. It's kind of remarkable you said I want to go again, and that the director didn't say wait, I'm really attached.
No, and I think it's important. I mean, like, I can't speak for Zach in this, but I mean, I could just imagine, like, even if he could reshoot the whole movie from the ground up with like things that he learned in the last 4 or 5 years, he would potentially sign up for that as well. But I mean, that would be just too much money, right? To get everybody back in and just do it from scratch. But with music, it was easier to just do that. And
well, easier for some.
Yeah.
You also pandemic.
Yeah, but I mean, And so I was actually getting to that because when I said at the beginning of this interview that it was actually a really great year for me last year and this year, that is purely from a work perspective. It was a very hard year, to see the hardship that so many people around the world were going through and are still going through. The fact that I was completely isolated from my friends and family in the Netherlands. There was no opportunity to travel to see them. You know, my dad is also 83. You know, he's getting older. He had periods where he wasn't not so great. And so not to be able to go and spend time with them and put them at risk, that was tough. And that was tough for a lot of people in the world to deal with that, and so what was great about it for me is that from a composer's standpoint of view, living in a pandemic or without the pandemic, it doesn't really make all that much difference. You know, you go to the studio, in my case usually around 4 or 5 in the morning, and you stop at around 8-9 o'clock at night. You have dinner, you make some phone calls, and you watch a little bit of Netflix, and you go to bed. How is that any different than the year before when there was no pandemic? It's not. So what was interesting, though, is that I have this super tiny house in Tarzana that I just love to live. And I have this tiny little room upstairs, which is only 5 by 5 feet or 5 by 6 feet. And I basically built a work setup there. And I just worked from there on my own for a whole year. And that was interesting because it was absolutely in complete isolation with no crosstalk with my assistants or with anybody. And it was that was very interesting. And it made it more intense. And at the same time, I'm sure you've heard this with some other composers that you talk to, or you will in the coming episodes, is that everybody had to be so darn creative this year, like how to get music recorded, how to get it mixed, and how to get it out. And when I mean get it out, is physically, how do I upload 180 gigabytes of data within 6 hours so people have it in time? You know, it's incredible. And that's where I felt so blessed because I call myself a full contact composer, which means I play a lot of instruments, but I also record all my stuff. I mix all my stuff. I master all my stuff. How happy was I that I knew these skills from back in the day? Because I was able to do everything on my own here upstairs without having to rely on a studio that mixes all my stuff, and then it comes back, and then this and that. So it was challenging to record because from the orchestral side of things, and I'm going to now name like a few movies in a group that I've worked on last year. One is Godzilla vs. Kong. Then it's the spy movie 355 for Universal that is coming out at a certain point, and Justice League, and Army of the Dead. So I have seen recording scenarios with one violin player in his bedroom, and then and then it was, oh, we can record three string players max in this little studio over here, with masks and with plastic shields and everything. And then there was a moment, oh, it's going better now in London. We can record 18 string players in one room. And then 2 days later, sorry, Tom, the restrictions have been back on. We can't record anybody here. That you have to do it at home. So I have so many different types of recording. And I had to mix all these recording to make sure that it constantly sounded as one film score throughout. So it was so much extra work. Normally, when a movie is done and you go into the orchestration process, recording and mixing, LA is such a well-oiled machine. And so are some of these other international cities that are focused on film music. We can do it in 10 days if we have to. Score is done. Poof, army of orchestrators, let's get all the people in the room, let's record it, a few different mix studios, everything, and it's done in 10, 12 days. With COVID, 18 weeks for the same work. 18 weeks. It's
and
insane.
Then stuff's probably out of sync. You have to, because it's not all done at the same time. So it's not recorded in one spot. So then you have to kind of piece that puzzle all together too.
It's incredible because I would get recordings from a violin player. I would get all the separate little takes that he did, punch in, punch out, and I get like hundreds of files.
You have to comp everything, or
I have to piece the whole thing together. And then somebody was working with this software. Somebody's working with that software. One person records him or herself with one microphone. Another person has five microphones to record. It was insane.
But it's great. Really a testament to your creativity. No, that's what I'm saying, and your attitude, that it was great. Because a lot of people could say, you know, I'm going to freak out how difficult this is. What's fun for us is the number of interviews we've done, some in person, where here you've said you're a full contact composer. You realize that some of your esteemed comrades out there and colleagues who shall remain nameless aren't really clear on which the USB port is and have to call the assistant in from the other room. We've been through all this. They're brilliant composers, but kind of, is this microphone, let me scratch it, you know, is this on? Because I'm not, so to see, think that there's Tom out there who can literally soup two nuts, knock it all down. Kenny, should we, on that note, soup the nuts?
Yeah. Yeah, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to talk more Justice League and Army of the Dead as well. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Hey, it's Matt Schrader here. If you like Score the Podcast, you're going to want to check out More Score, our new Patreon show for Score superfans. What's Patreon? Well, it's a website and an app that lets fans crowdfund the type of extra content you want. And now, More Score has it all on video. You can listen or watch right on the Patreon app. More Score already has the life stories of people you know, like Kenny and Robert from Score the Podcast, as well as bonus features, hangouts, and yes, original interviews, like Carlos Rafael Rivera from The Queen's Gambit on Netflix. Did you know he had to throw out his score and start fresh? More Score gives you insight into the film score world, and it's a beautiful addition to those of you who just can't wait for another episode of Score the Podcast. Best of all, More Score is year-round. No more off-season. Go to patreon.com/morescore or download the Patreon app and search More Score.
Hi, this is Ludwig Göransson. You're listening to Score the Podcast, and now let's go back to the show.
Welcome back to the season premiere of Score the Podcast, presented by Spitfire Audio. We're here with Tom Holkenborg, and we were just talking a little bit about Justice League. I wanted to ask you, though, because this film wasn't going to have a normal theatrical release. This was kind of one of the first direct-to-streaming service movies that could have been in the theater. Was there a different process for you and Zach? Was there a little more leeway? Were you involved as much with studio executives in putting this together, since it was a director's cut and it was kind of, you know, 4 hours long? I mean, it was kind of a different approach, it felt, but was it for you?
This project is unique in any form, you know, especially in my young career and probably for a while to come, because it is called the Zack Snyder Cut, you know, so you can't call something a Zack Snyder Cut if the process of finishing a film is how it normally is with producers and influence of studios and everything. So it was a unique process, which basically meant I was only talking to Zach and nobody else. Whereas on a normal film, it's very normal that you have meetings with the music department of the studio, and they have a certain vision or opinion. And filmmaking usually is teamwork. It's incredible, talented producers, really smart people that are the executives at studios, the music department, the production department, the director and his production company, the composer, the visual effects artist, the Foley effects, the special effects, audio department. And they all stick their heads together. And that's how a movie is being made, you know, with the director being the captain of the ship. But there is a massive crew on the ship, on the director's side. Let's go over there, starboard. Then it's like 40 people start running on the ship to make that ship move, you know, right, in the slowest possible terms to the right. And that's what filmmaking is. It's teamwork. It's a complex set of parameters. So if you're only talking to the director at this point and nobody else, that is pretty unique.
How different was it, though, when you jumped into this second round? Because you said you started over, but was there, I think you had said that you had scored half of the film, or initially the 2-hour version. How different was it? Did he start over as well, or did he kind of keep what he had in the initial beginning of it? Because it got longer, obviously.
Well, I mean, Zach shot like a huge amount of extra shots during the whole recording of the original Justice League, and then eventually the movie could not exceed 2 hours, which turned the storytelling aspect really into like a rush, you know, just like to get all the story beats out. And what is interesting about the 4.5-hour cut that is out right now is that it is not just a nonstop, senseless action movie. There's a lot of space in it for dialogue, to discover the backstory of all these different characters. And sometimes just to play out a great scene with no dialogue or no music at all, just like enjoy the visuals. And that's what's really great about the vision that he initially had.
There is some beautiful kind of, I don't know if it's Schadenfreude or justice, that he gets to tell the epic entire story. I just wonder, when it was decided that you would go again, didn't you have commitments to other films? Godzilla was coming at you, or Army of the Dead? How did you say, I'm also going to add this to my plate? And how did those other
squeeze
films
in a 4-hour movie?
Yeah, how did those other films react? Were they unhappy? Well, did they know?
Yeah, because I'm always playing open cards. What goes on in my life, which prevents a lot of trouble down the line. And so I can say in all honesty that Godzilla vs. Kong was completely wrapped up before I started on Justice League. The whole movie was done and dusted March nice. Last year, beginning of April. Army of the Dead was nearly done. So I had a whole year ahead to finish Justice League and to finish the 355 movie with Simon Kinberg. But that movie score is way lighter in nature, and it's small instrumentation, small percussion. It's not a big action score like Justice League. So I will say, though, that the bigger the score in production also means it takes more man hours to finish it. It's really true. And so I was it doesn't matter how talented you are. I was playing, like, the other day the what was it, the first Jurassic Park with the score from John Williams, and it's like you can just hear it's a lot of work to put all these notes on paper, you know. It's just a lot of work.
And yet we can sit here and go, ba-da-da, ba-da, ba-da-da,
yeah.
And it just stays, and everybody turns around and goes, oh, that's Jurassic Park. I mean, it all comes down to, in so many ways, some melody that stays with us. 355 could not have had the amount of fervor online as a Justice League with fans and, hey, man, can you tell us a little about that? I, for one, I usually know a little about these things. Tell me about that film, whatever you can.
It hasn't come out, so there's not much I can say. It hasn't come out yet, so it's like
spy movie.
Yeah, it's a great cast, and Jessica Chastain is in it. Penelope Cruz is in it. It's a great cast. It's a really fun movie.
Oh, great!
But like that movie, there's so many movies that are still being shelved. I remember we're still waiting for a James Bond. We're still waiting for God knows all these big movies that have been finished by these big studios, but they're picking the right moment to release them. So for Warner Brothers to take this choice to do like this joint release, you know, in HBO Max and theater at the same time, not only is a very brave decision, but it's also a very interesting business venture, you know, to see like, hey, you know, it is a possibility to release something exactly on the same day on a digital medium and in the theater, of which I think a lot of people believed if that was even possible, you know, to do that. And it's clear that it can work. So and I'm not a brilliant business person in that sense at all. That's why I work with people that are. But I'm very curious to see, you know, how this experiment is going to play out in the next 5 to 10 years. Are we looking at a completely different model, how multimedia as a conglomerate is being released, and how it's going to get consumed in the future by customers, whether at home or a special theater? It's very interesting to see.
Well, it brings up an interesting question, too. I was just going to say, as a composer, does that change the way you score a big blockbuster film, knowing that it's going to be watched in more homes versus at the theater? Do you mix things differently? Do you use different types of instruments? Does that change your approach at all?
It changes a little bit. It's like if you consider that the majority of the people are actually consuming TV shows and movies or from their iPhone or from their iPad or from their laptop while laying in bed or chilling out, the number is staggering. And then there's a group of people that have a big TV setup at home with like a sort of like surround environment to really enjoy a film. And then there's people that don't do that at all and only want to go to the theater and watch a movie. What I'm heading at is like, as the screen gets smaller and the speakers get smaller that you listen on, it means that you can overstep your music writing and your production by quite a bit to fill the gap of not experience it so big. So if you watch something in IMAX and your editing style of the picture would be the same as like a music video you would watch on your phone, you would go absolutely totally dizzy. So the fact that something is an IMAX and so big, it means that you need to keep a few rules in mind, because you will drive the people absolutely crazy in the theater not knowing where to focus. George Miller said to me once, he was able to edit Mad Max so insanely crazy because the center point of the action is always in the middle of the screen. You never need to move your eyes. You can just stare at the middle of the screen, and then the edits can go really, really fast because you don't need to look around. Remember some of these Tony Scott movies from the 90s, early 2000s?
Absolutely.
Where the editing style was so crazy. And at the same time, you had to focus left and right. Where's the action? Where am I supposed to focus on? And that was a very interesting experiment. One movie I worked on with Harry Gregson-Williams is Domino, which is absolutely crazy in that editing style. And it's you have to almost see it twice in a theatrical setting, because your eyes are often in the wrong spot of the screen where something is happening there. But the shots are edited so quick that you have to see them again just for that. Whereas Fury Road, just focus on the middle of the screen.
Do you think George, this is the dumbest question I could ask, but do you think George very consciously shot and framed to make sure that the center of the screen...
They redid scenes up to 10, 15 times to make sure that the focus was in the middle of the camera.
Because he knew how he wanted to edit it. I wonder if Tony Scott also, because now I'm thinking back, Harry worked on Man on Fire, which we did, and that's also really jagged feel to it. And I don't know if that was Tony Scott's emotional approach or not.
Well, I met Tony only once, and I would say he's an absolute brilliant director. And so for me, he was like the king in the movie genre between like $40 and $70 million, which was like a forgotten area of filmmaking, right? It was $150 million plus, or it was like...
12.
You know, it was like 12, you know, and he filled the gap in between. And he was the king in that genre. And he experimented with so many interesting ways of telling a story, editing, using music. I remember because Harry was his go-to guy, yeah? Harry Gregson.
Always.
I remember that he was constantly pushing Harry to go more extreme and to go more this and to go more that. He had a really, really strong vision. And it's very unfortunate that he's not with us anymore. Yeah. But I think you can conclude that whatever he did on movies was a very, very deliberate choice to do it like that.
I'm sure. It's like an engineer, you know, why did you record the guitar, you know, that particular way? Was that an accident? No, I wanted a certain ambience. I wanted a certain room sound.
Yeah.
It's just, you've educated me. Next picture I see, I'm going to look at how it's framed.
Yeah, I never thought of it that way.
Because, you know, as musicians and film fans, I'm always, of course, just hanging on the story. I'm not thinking a lot about the directorial choices. And I like now knowing that that's something that now makes me want to go back and see Fury Road, one of my favorites. And it actually ties into something I learned from you, which is the programming of drums in Fury Road is insane and signature. It's almost like a melody. And to think that you went and had another drum built for Godzilla, I thought, wait, you have those cool, don't you have the Fury Road drums?
Yeah. No,
who's going to know? Why would you go build
Are you building any
drum?
New instruments?
Yeah, yeah.
For your upcoming films?
Yeah, I'm constantly building new stuff or designing new stuff. And obviously, because of the pandemic, we are less mobile. It also means that you cannot get together with a group of people just like that, you know, to do this or to do that. There are limitations. For starters, most of the studios wouldn't let you record over the last year, unless it was under super strict rules. So it meant that I had to be more creative and do more things on my own that are within my reach to do. But the Fury Road drums are definitely one of the better sounding drum kits, period. But even if that is the case, it's time to move on. You know,
you are unique in that a lot of people wouldn't
He's
have
ready for
your
something new.
Energy and ambition. Tell me, when you think about what's coming up, we're all looking at crystal balls. Do you think you'll be back in a studio in 2021 with a big band in front of you? Or do you think, just like the films that are now coming on to our home screens and out of theaters, do you think you'll be doing more at home?
I think the pandemic has taught us a couple of different things. For starters, at least in my world, in my life, is how much a human being needs physical contact with another human being in one room. I'm not necessarily meaning touching, but just like feel each other's energy, be in each other's energy field. Hmm. And to have 90 people sit in front of you that all put their best forward, that all bring their 30 to 35 years of excruciating experience in controlling and playing their instrument, all at the same time playing your piece of music, that is not even necessarily the sound that comes off it, but the energy in that room to make that possible is just incredible. You don't feel that on Zoom. You don't feel that on Skype. But we also learned something else, is that we did have a huge amount of meetings and hanging around that were absolutely pointless and a complete waste of time. The other thing I found out is that conference calls with people on Zoom or Skype turned people into more human people. Because once you have a woman on the other side who is trying to explain her marketing plan to approach the marketing of certain products, and you hear three kids screaming in the background, you feel for that woman. It's like, how are you able to do such fantastic work while being at home with three kids that are willing to kill each other every day because they can't go to school, they can't go to a park, they just have to stay inside. And or a guy who cannot walk so great and his dog is like, it's like tearing up the couch behind him while he's on a Zoom call. He's like, hey, Johnny, cut that out. Johnny. And then it's like, oh, shit, I'll be right back. And then, so people got, because of this, people became way more empathetic to each other. The other thing I noticed is that people don't interrupt each other that much. If you go into a meeting room with 10 people, two are very loud and very dominant. Then there's a few that only say when things are being asked, and the other five just sit there and make notes. On a Zoom call, everybody gets their turn. People actually listen better to each other, and the rules of engagement of a good conversation are better obliged in a Zoom call than in a room filled with people. So there's a lot of things we learned.
So positive.
Are there any pros to what happened here? We hear a lot of the cons. We need to get back into the room, the energy. We'd love to have that. But there's no pros to saving time other than obviously the meeting thing. But is there anything that you're able to utilize now that, because, I mean, we've seen this technology in just a year go from nobody knew what a Zoom was to now my mom's like, well, why aren't we Zooming on this?
Okay.
And, I mean,
but
people are using that.
Let me give you a few simple examples that everybody who plays an instrument knows. When you're playing in a band, like whether it's an orchestral band or it's like a brass band or a real band, you're not always on the top of your game. And sometimes you're not feeling it, and you're just like hanging out there on stage, and you're just like hanging back. You're playing it wrong because there's a few others that are carrying the torch that night. When people have to record at home, the only thing they're listening to is themselves. So they have to like, shit. And it's like, again, again. And then so they push themselves to really high performance. So now when I get a recording back from 20 violins, I'm looking at star violinist solo performances one by one by one by one. Whereas if you record a string section, a few are excellent and the rest are just kind of hanging in there because they had a fight with their kids in the morning or their car was broken into and they're not super focused. It's human. It's absolutely 100% human. And so there's a benefit to this. Other than that, I find myself to be way more productive working from home without distraction of people around me or the office between brackets. There's way less senseless hanging around and getting drawn into conversations that you don't want to be part of. I'm not saying that everything in a week's work need to only be geared towards productivity and efficiency and how can we do things faster so there's more time to do more work. I think for me, it's like with a shorter working day, I get more accomplished and I have way more time at night to, you know, enjoy sit outside in the yard with my dog and a glass of wine. It's like, oh, what a great day. When I work in a studio, so much time gets unnecessarily lost. And then I have to work till 1 o'clock and 2 o'clock at night to get the work done. So it's actually more efficient, more productive, and at the same time, way more time to do other things. I'm Skyping with my best friends in Holland every day since the pandemic began for 2 hours. We're on a Skype call together. It starts at noon, LA time, every day. And we're on there for 2 hours discussing all kinds of random stuff. This was impossible a year and a half ago. I would say, I have no time. No, you do have time, but you lose so much time doing other things that are not important. So,
like driving places.
But for instance, I mean, executives are very happy because they can do up to 10 meetings that are like 50 minutes or 20 minutes long on Zoom, very focused, go through everything. I mean, as an executive, Robert, you know, in LA, you could maybe do 3 meetings in a day and your day is gone.
Two. If they one in Santa Monica and one in Burbank, you know, that was
that's
like
it.
You had the morning meeting.
Oh, yeah.
And you had the afternoon meeting. And that was it. And here, you're literally, the only stress is, oh, where's the Zoom link? I can't find that email. That's like the extent of your pressure on the meeting, and then you get on and it is very focused.
We know you have a hard out, so I just really quick before we go, Army of the Dead, is it still May 14th?
I'm actually not sure. I thought it was end of May, but maybe it is, but let's just check it. Let's not guess.
Anything you can tell us about it?
What is really interesting about that movie is that it's super far from being a typical zombie movie, but I'm not going to say anything more than just that because I don't want to spoil it. And musically, it's interesting too because I'm basically juxtaposing whatever you see on screen with my music by taking a completely different approach to things. So the music for this film is actually very small and very emotional most of the time. Well, in fact, what you're seeing on screen is quite the opposite.
The trailer is amazing.
Cool.
That trailer is so cool.
I can't wait for
it. A real surprise, too.
Well, we want to thank Tom for joining the show. Be sure to subscribe and check out Studio Time. And Tom's social media is one of the best in the film music community as well, so follow him on Instagram and Twitter. A reminder to our listeners, you can follow us. There's a number of ways. Twitter, @ScoreThePodcast. Instagram, @ScoreMovie. Facebook, Score a Film Music Documentary. And don't forget to subscribe on Patreon for more Score. Just search More Score on your desktop or mobile app. A lot more interviews, and it's year-round, so we're never in an off-season. Tom, thanks so much for joining the show today.
Thank you, guys.
I want to thank you also for your inspiration. It really is your inspiration. Your attitude's inspiring. It's just, it reminds me of looking at things from a positive point of view. I also hope your back is better.
Yeah, feel better.
It healed itself during this conversation.
See, that's it.
How was that?
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, Score the Podcast.
We'll take the credit
has
for that.
Therapeutic qualities that we'd like to share. If you're a composer, and you're having some trouble, physical, emotional, spiritual, come on the show. You'll feel
better. Listen to 2 episodes a day and call us next week.
Hey, Score listeners, we are so grateful for the support of Spitfire Audio. They collaborate with people like Hans Zimmer and the Bernard Herrmann Estate to build sample libraries that elevate your music. You're about to hear a musical demo of what that sounds like.
As an exclusive to our Score listeners, Spitfire Audio is offering 25% off your first order. That's good for over 50 of their libraries. And you just have to use the promo code SCORE2021. Again, 25% off your first order using that promo code SCORE2021. It's an exclusive to you, our Score the Podcast listeners. Just go to SpitfireAudio.com and enter the promo code in so they know we sent you. Now we're going to play you a sample cue from the Abbey Road 1 Orchestral Foundations package so you can hear some of the different sounds that that package offers. Check it out. Once again, you can save 25% off your first Spitfire order with the promo code SCORE2021. Robert, what